All right, this is Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett. It's Saturday night, and this is a show I've been looking forward to for weeks. So good evening, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea, and to the hostile alien armies hovering silently behind their cloaking devices just outside the Earth's atmosphere. Remember, eat the Canadians first. They are much tastier. And yet I should almost feel compelled to say, you know, of course I'm joking, love the Canadians, and I would never eat another human being. Reason I say that is there have been times in the history of our country where even to joke about something like that might have gotten you thrown into jail, or at least had a lot of eyebrows thrown your way. So it was in the case of the 17th century in Salem, Massachusetts. During that heightened fear, this bubbling sense that these communities were going to fail and they were under siege by dark forces and they become somewhat xenophobic about anybody coming into the town. And what they were certainly most afraid of was, in some level, were witches and warlocks, people who were practicing dark arts. And so even things that might have been said in jest might have led eventually to your arrest and perhaps your hanging, most witches not being burned. But we're going to talk about the Salem witch trials tonight, next hour, in a way that will challenge the way most people think they know about what happened, and more importantly, where their sympathies might, in the end, be best placed. When it comes to the Salem witch trials, it almost seems universal to the casual observer that, well, of course, you know, we feel bad when somebody is murdered, you know, for something they didn't do and or accused of something in these bizarre, you know, circular manner, you know, the way the local governments work to try to always find some sort of scapegoat for the problems of the community. We can still feel bad about that, but there might be other things about learning the truth behind the Salem witch trials and the way that historians have switched their view about what has happened, the more information has come out over the years that might get you switching sides. That's the book we'll talk about next hour. This hour, different story, crypto news, and a look back at a caller last night on Open Lines. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. It's a fun show Friday night on Coast to Coast. We had Lauren Weinstein back on again because of the subject that had come up surprisingly on Friday about the recording of the president by his personal attorney and some of the privacy issues that have come up in the last couple of weeks about people recording each other. One of those had to do with police officers. So I've asked our first hour guest to come on a little bit early. We'll get to something that somebody said last night while we were talking about privacy, and that was somebody who said it makes them, if you know, police officers have appropriately have body cams, and then there are dashboard cameras on police cruisers, but it's still a touchy thing for a lot of cops to be recorded by somebody standing on a sidewalk. And so even though they're recording other people, they don't may or may not like it when other people are recording them, but that may be just the world we're in, where everybody is going to be recording each other. There are good things about that, and there are plenty of bad. One of those has to do, though, with a big story that was in the news earlier this week, and even one from today. You know, so glad things resolved easily or with less bloodshed than it looked like it was shaping up to anyway in Los Angeles with the Trader Joe's that was the subject of a siege at one point as police officers were in there or surrounding this Trader Joe's where a man who was accused of killing his own grandmother had taken hostages. Looked like everybody did their jobs. Everything worked out fine in the end with at least everybody coming out seemingly unharmed. I haven't heard an update whether or not that isn't true. But that's, you know, that's just the hard job that cops have every day. And it's also the hard job of the press to cover those types of live events. And that may also be another aspect of this future that we're entering into. And I want to get back to a question that had come up last night with that regard when we talked to Randy Sutton a little bit earlier in just a moment. A follow-up promise from last night. By the way, if you didn't hear the show, and here I am, I've said last night about five times. Remember, you can always listen to those if you're a Coast insider. Any Coast show in the archive, anything as recent as 24 hours, and even, I believe, shows into the future. Find out more about Coast Insider by signing up at coasttocoastam.com, where there's also a good story that leads off crypto news for tonight. Stunning new images taken from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter have revealed that Mars is undergoing a planet-wide transformation. A global dust storm recently engulfed the entire surface of the red planet, an occurrence which apparently happens every 3 to 4 Mars years. It was part of the plot, remember, in The Martian, wasn't it, that he gets caught in that dust storm? The massive storm can even be seen from Earth using amateur telescopes. Quote, with a decent telescope, observers can see the polar caps growing and shrinking in the dust storms, said Dr. Robert Massey, Deputy Executive Director for the Royal Astronomical Society. I live in the desert now, as I think some of you know. I live here in the Southwest in Arizona, and we may even get a dust storm tonight while we're talking. There is a warning out for thunderstorms, and that frequently is anticipated by a dust storm, and then the thunder and rain can come in behind that. Around here, those are called haboobs. Commonly, people talk about them using the Arabic word, and so haboobs are not uncommon. We usually get 3 or 4 a year, and there's something, right? I mean, if you've ever been in one of those things, they are incredible. It's just like it is in that Mission Impossible movie, whichever the one is where he has to climb on the outside of the building. But although I should say, the old timers of Arizona, you know what the old timers of Arizona refer to dust storms as? Dust storms. They totally resisted the whole haboob thing. I think it's dumb. Daily Mail says plants could act as an early warning system to protect us from hazardous substances in our homes. According to a new study, plants, which are naturally sensitive to chemicals and bacteria that are present in the air, could become biosensors. Scientists are able to artificially enhance this trait in plants, adding more stomata or stomata. You say stomata, I say whatever that is. It's the tiny opening or pore which allows gases inside the cells of plants. So previous research had designed genetically modified household plants that would change color, or they would fluoresce when exposed to mold or even things like influenza in the air. If somebody was spreading the flu, the plant would signal you. Maybe even radon gas. This is the component of them that would make them a biosensor, and they would be growing in the walls of houses, which I think is really cool. Although I knew some guys in college, of course, who were growing plants in between the walls with special lights, if you know what I mean. I'm sure they were hoping that those plants could have told them when the cops were coming. But the Mirror UK reporting that a man was left in shock after spotting what he describes as a dog man, a 6-foot half man, half dog creature running through the woods. You can see this image if you go to the news section on coasttocoastam.com. Scott Carpenter was his name. He was walking when he saw the dark colored beast and decided to start shooting. He used a computer software and stabilization tools on his own video to slow down the action. He claims shows creepy details about the odd creature. I'll be honest with you, I don't know that I saw that. I mean, I was watching because I sort of think the whole dogman thing is really cool. And dogman stories versus stories of werewolves, a very interesting distinction. I don't know that he makes the case in this footage, but you can go see it for yourself at coasttocoastam.com. And if you go online, you'll see some pretty cool new trailers that are out for some of the movies that are coming for the end of the year. Many of them are horror movies. And including what this weekend, isn't that the new, is it this weekend is the new, next weekend is the next, is the new Mission Impossible movie, which also looks good. They're doing remakes of Robin Hood. Seven of them are on the way. That according to the AV Club, they say that seven remakes are on various schedules in Hollywood. Robin Hood Oranges, sorry, Origin, Origins, probably should be Oranges. A version from Sony called Hood that was said to be like Mission Impossible. And then also a version from Disney called Nottingham and Hood from a script by Brandon Barker and a take from Warner Brothers we don't know much about yet, but it's already gotten a green light. You know, seven different Robin Hoods also mean seven different Maid Marians, seven different takes on the Sheriff of Nottingham, Friar Tuck, Little John, Will Scarlet. It's always interesting to see how that story is reinterpreted. This we just went through this though, right? With all the different Sherlock Holmeses that popped up. Now it's back to being Robin Hood's turn, I guess. Margot Robbie, by the way, will be one of those Maid Marians in her movie. Maid Marian becomes a vigilante after Robin Hood is killed. And then there's Robin Hood 2058 and Robin Hood Prince of Aragon. The first one takes place, quote, in a futuristic dystopian London, and it centers on a rogue MI5 agent on a mission to avenge injustice. Like the injustice that comes when they remake Robin Hood movies too many times. And the Prince of Aragon is apparently a vibrant punk pop retelling of the whole mythos. If you go back to the origins of Robin Hood, by the way, it ties back into a poem, an extended poem that was written in the 14th century called Piers Plowman. And I thought, it occurred to me while I was looking at this story, you know who's like one of the experts on Piers Plowman, this 14th century epic poem that references Robin Hood? It's older than Canterbury Tales, Piers Plowman. And the expert, the only person I've ever known who we would call an expert is Bill Burns. We just had him on a couple of weeks ago, right? Who is also an expert on Hedy Lamarr and then is on all the time talking about UFOs. That Bill Burns, he got his PhD in English literature, and that was the subject of his dissertation, was Piers Plowman, that the story, the original story. And I saw the trailer online too for Aquaman. The trailer looks cool. But then I always have to remind myself, it's DC, they're going to screw it up. It's DC, they're going to screw it up. It's, you know, the trailers always look good, but it's DC and they're going to screw it up. Although they didn't screw up Wonder Woman too much. So who knows? Toss a coin. But that goes to show you, we crave hero stories, right? As a culture, we're always looking for hero stories. These are stories, you know, on which we can model our own behavior. Ways for us to understand right and wrong, to sort of process the best outcomes under stress. Heroes are good for that. And that that's what brought me to asking Randy Sutton, the author of The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People, to be a first hour guest today before we get to our conversation next hour about witches. Now, Randy Sutton's police career spanned three award-winning decades in the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. He's been featured on Cops, America's Most Wanted, and apparently had some role in the movie Casino. I don't know about that. We'll find out. And other shows and stuff. He's the founder of the Wounded Blue, created to assist law enforcement officers who are injured physically and psychologically to obtain the treatment and medical financial benefits they need when they suffer line of duty injuries. And he also writes extensively on the topics of ethics, integrity, and leadership, which brings us back to the power of legacy, personal heroes of America's most inspiring people. Randy Sutton, how are you this evening?
I'm fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on your show tonight, Ian.
Oh, happy to. And we have a very dear mutual friend in Wendy Garisco, so.
Yes, we do. Yes, we
Yeah,
do.
she's fabulous. So, it came up last night. We were talking about where we stand right now with regard to all of the recording that goes on in our culture. And I was trying to make a part of an argument anyway last night about how maybe we should all not only just be good with the fact that we're being recorded all the time, but maybe we should be doing more recording ourselves. And that if you're going into a law office, for example, don't wonder whether or not the lawyer is recording you, record them. Especially when it comes to financial transactions, somebody told me they never talk to a lawyer unless they're recording everything that that lawyer says. But the same thing has come up a lot with police. And just about any time somebody gets pulled over for a stop, now it takes it out of the he said routine, and somebody could record that with their phone. You've been a cop for a long time, so you were a cop before all of this recording was taking place, before the body cam, before the dash cams, and before people with handheld phones and cameras and microphones. Where are you with all of that?
Well, actually, believe it or not, law enforcement officers, even before all of this modern body cam stuff, were secretly recording people in order to protect themselves. I was actually one of them. I had a pocket recorder in my breast pocket on all my car stops, as many of us did, because of the false complaints that were often filed against us. So we were actually proactive.
You were pioneers in this.
Yeah, exactly. We were pioneers, but we were just trying to protect ourselves, because
right.
the fact is that and I keep in mind that I was a police supervisor for 20 years. I was a lieutenant and a sergeant. So people would make complaints, and I would have to investigate them. People make complaints against my officers. So I understood that in order to protect yourself, you needed to be proactive, because, as you said, it's a he said, she said thing, unless there is some type of record made. So when all of this madness started under the Obama administration, when it was, let's protect the people from the police, I kind of laughed, because I knew the realities that it was going to be, well, actually, those body cameras and dash cameras are going to protect the police from the people.
But I thought those arguments were made simultaneously. I didn't think it was exclusive at all to just, we're going to protect the people from the police. I thought part of the argument that was made from the very beginning, because I resonated with it and I was doing talk radio at the time and I was all for it, which is interesting in light of what you said, because some of the more over the top, and I'm going to say this for lack of a better term, but I don't mean this as pejorative as it sounds, but some of the real pound the table law and order callers, they were against body cameras. And I was saying, no, this is the best possible outcome. This will save municipalities lawsuits. This is going to be, and I thought that was part of the argument even from the beginning. It was baked in that, just like you said, it would establish some sort of horizon line for what happened whenever a stop took place. But it would also stop, and we do know that it happens, where there would be false reports made after an incident, where the reports were lined up, and we know this because cops ended up losing their jobs over it and under certain circumstances, where there was some protection that was going on. And that was, hopefully, that was going to eliminate that. But even there was to bring about more confidence into the police department, right?
Well, of course, the way this was sold to the American public was in light of Ferguson, the great lies of Ferguson, the hands up, don't shoot nonsense, and all of the negativity that came out of that and many other high profile uses of force. So the rhetoric was, we need to protect the public from the police, and that's how it was sold, and that's how government grants were given on a wholesale basis. But you know, those in law enforcement, you know, here's the thing. It is a terrible pain in the neck to be recorded for everything that you do and say.
Okay? Yeah, tell me about it.
You know,
That's how I live my life, being recorded. So it doesn't bother me, but go ahead.
Well, when you are talking, you know, you keep in mind that law enforcement officers have most of their day is spent in interactions with human beings. And when you know that everything that you say and do is being recorded, it has a chilling effect on some of the more personal interactions that take place. You know, you want to be personable with people, but all of those things can be interpreted in different ways. So the way the whole body camera and dash camera idea was sold was, you know, the police are negative, the police are doing all these bad things to people, and we need to protect them. That's the way it was sold.
I just don't remember, though. I remember it being both, but I appreciate your point of view on that. Let me just do this. Let's put a pin in that for the moment, because I want to get to the power of legacy, personal heroes of America's most inspiring people, before we get to the Salem witch trials coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Bonnet. So most of the times you've heard the story about what happened in Salem, Massachusetts in the 17th century, even before there was a U.S. In colonial America, there were some trends that maybe still continue this day in the way in which we think about who's inside, who's outside. But the story of the Salem witch trials contains many more nuances than I think any of us might have expected. And when you say it's a witch hunt, might be surprised to find out what that really might have meant in Salem in the 17th century. We'll get to that coming up next hour. We'll be talking with Tony Fells, a professor who's been researching all of the books about the Salem witch trials. He suggests by the end of the interview, you'll be switching sides. How a generation of historians lost sympathy for the victims of the Salem witch hunt, coming up next hour. But we'll find out more about these everyday shootings, these everyday heroes who are out there working in the beats, with Randy Sutton next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, let me backtrack just a little bit and ask Randy Sutton, author of the new book. Well, it's not a new book, but just out in paperback, The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People, and a veteran police officer in Las Vegas. By the way, do you know George Knapp? Does that name anything
to you? I know George very well. Thank you. Oh, yeah.
Has he been on your show? Have you been on his show?
I've been interviewed by George several times.
And, oh, good.
He's quite a journalist.
Yeah. So am I wrong in thinking that you would take out body cams then and not have?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I'm a proponent.
Okay. And dashboard cams you're cool with, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because it just seems like, you know, everybody's recording everybody. So it just seems like the more we have and from different perspectives, As weird as it may be in our story of our culture, it seems better to be there than trying to fight it and only have audio or not have audio and video, or only have video without audio. What did you make of a story, by the way, before I ask you more about the book, but about the story earlier this week? There was a police officer, there was a body cam video that made it look a lot like a first person shooter game, where the cop who was driving was firing through his own windshield at the car they were chasing. And when I watch that, I mean, it's all very heroic and very dramatic and makes great, you know, TV and stuff. But how is that in terms of following police procedure? Is that common?
It's not common, but in this particular case, it was well within the guidelines. That actually was a case out of Las Vegas, where I was a police officer for 24 years.
Right.
And that officer was very heroic. You got to remember that we were dealing with a situation where it was extreme. These were gang members that had just murdered another person.
Right.
When the officer tried to make the car stop,
he took off. Right.
Well, they took off. They were in pursuit, but not only pursuit, but the suspects fired more than 30 rounds at the police officer.
Right.
So when he got into a position, and you could see, if you saw the entire video, He kept a very tactical distance. He was swerving to avoid the bullets that were you know, taking place all around him. And then when he got in a position where he was in a more isolated area, he got right on their bumper, opened fire on them through their open window, and then wound up in a ferocious gunfight. I mean, when you talk about courage,
yeah,
this officer epitomized courage.
Yeah. Well, it certainly looked that way, and I just wasn't sure what the procedure was. But it was amazing to watch, and everybody's, you know, I think we should all be grateful when every police officer goes home, you know, alive at the end of a shift, because it's a job that not many people can do well, and the people that do it under a great amount of stress. How many police officers are in your book, The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People?
Actually, very few. This book was, I've written four books. This is my fourth. And I wrote this book after I suffered a stroke in my police car.
Oh, sorry.
And I was given a very, shall we say, not a very good prognosis for my future.
Right.
And as I was thinking about what my legacy would be, I wanted to leave something behind that was going to be positive. And I happened to be watching an interview with a former Arizona State Trooper named Frank Shankwitz, who created one of the most incredible organizations in modern history, the Make-A-Wish Foundation, touching the lives of millions of people around the world when he was an Arizona trooper. And that's when I realized there were people who have done extraordinary things in their life. And I wanted to talk to them about who their personal heroes were in order to create an inspirational book that would encourage all people to want to be personal heroes. And that's what The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People is all about. I traveled the country. I talked to people like Gary Sinise, who has done amazing things for veterans, Frank Shankwitz, who created the Make-A-Wish Foundation, but also many people whose names you've never heard, but whose lives have touched others around the globe. And that's what this book is all about. And I'm really very, very proud of it, and proud of the people who shared with me their personal stories.
And the fact that it is now coming out in paperback, that's great these days, because not many things even survive hardcover for very long. So congratulations.
Well, it's not only paperback, it's on Kindle, and it was just released in audio as well.
Well, Kindle's pretty easy. I mean, I'm just saying, you know, I'm glad it's on Kindle, but for somebody to actually, I mean, I know a little bit about the publishing thing, and it's more, it's really, I mean, it's really, it's much more of a compliment that a paperback version has come out than a Kindle version, because Kindle's just, you know, zeros and ones. But for somebody to invest in a paper distribution, that's really something. So how do you define heroes? How do we look at heroes in our culture, and has our understanding of heroes changed?
That is a great question. And that's, I believe that a hero is someone who has touched the life of another person and left that life better than it was before. You know, oftentimes we equate heroes with personal courage, with physical courage. And while that is, of course, a huge component, heroes are those who think and act outside of the norm, and they are they touch the lives of others so that those lives are better than they were before. That's the way when I think of a hero, it's much more than just personal courage, although that's, of course, a huge component. I've known many, many heroes who have evidenced that by their actions.
Yeah. So I'll return back to the follow-up to that is, has our understanding of heroes changed? If you looked at a book with a similar theme as yours, you know, printed in the 1920s, would it contain the same type of people and the same types of stories?
You know, I love that question. When I was a young man, I looked upon a police officer as a hero. And that's why I became one, because I saw them as someone who was courageous, someone who was, you know, out there and made a difference in the lives of other people. And I wanted to be that person. Unfortunately, what we have seen in recent history is the demeaning of personal courage. And personal courage, I don't mean just physical. Law enforcement officers, people who are willing to place their lives on the line for others, military, they are heroes. And unfortunately, society has altered in a lot of the thinking and not only demeaned them, but created an environment where people who are growing up, children, aren't even given the ability to be exposed to that courage and be exposed to that kind of humanity. And by that, we take an entire generation and we don't allow them to become, to have something to aspire to. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote that book, because these aren't just law enforcement officers. These are people who, from every walk of life, who have just stepped up to the plate after experiencing great personal loss and pain, worked through that and changed the lives of others. And that's something that we all need to aspire to.
Yeah. So, love that. You've mentioned a couple. Give me another example of, because you're like, I think here, one of the reasons I sort of drawn to this idea is that every third movie, of course, is a superhero movie. And I think that, sort of, I mentioned earlier that, you know, they're bringing back new versions of Robin Hood, and that we use heroes as templates for how we want to be, or what we think we're missing, or what, you know, toward which we want to aspire. And it's equal for men and women. Everybody wants to feel like their life had value and that they did something and that it mattered that they were here. It's not always expressed in the same way. You know, there's some people who I would consider to be heroes who spent their whole life, you know, digging sanitary ditches in third world countries because that saved lives. And that was the same sort of, you know, and they'll never get the kind of recognition that they might have if they'd stayed in this country or if they'd done other things. But it was a sort of epic self-sacrifice. And so I just, you know, when I'm looking ahead at how we're looking at, you know, more of these superhero movies coming out and our craving for heroship and for people who are doing it the right way. What was another example in your book about somebody who has done something heroic that should be a model for us moving forward?
I can tell you right now. Her name is Bonnie Lucas. I don't know if you ever saw a movie called The Big Miracle about the saving of three whales, or actually the
saving
of two whales.
Right, where they cut the ice to get the whales to hopscotch out to the open water, basically.
Exactly. Right. Well, that was based on a true story. And I was actually interviewing Colonel Barney Barnum, who was a Medal of Honor recipient for incredible bravery for my book. And while I'm talking to him, he stops mid-sentence. He says, "Randy, I know who needs to be in your book, Bonnie Lucas." And I go, "Well, who's Bonnie Lucas?" He says, "Don't worry about it." And he gets on the phone, he calls her, and he says, "Bonnie, you need to be in Randy Sutton's book. And clearly she asked the same thing. Well, who the hell is Randy Sutton? And he says, don't worry, you need to be in his book. I'm sending him over to you. And I didn't have any idea who this woman was.
Which is awkward. If you don't like the story, it's kind of awkward, right?
Exactly. It was. Yeah. But Colonel Barney Barnum, a Medal of Honor recipient who gave unbelievable service to this country, sent me. So I went. I followed orders. And I met this woman who was incredible. Here's the story. She was Ronald Reagan's personal assistant. And Ronald Reagan comes out one day and says to her, Bonnie, there's three whales trapped under the ice in Alaska. Send our military to help get them out. And she tells me later, when I'm doing the interview, she says that's the way Ronald Reagan was. Now, this is the middle of the Cold War, right? So she contacts the head of the military, who is a National Guard officer, who doesn't believe her originally because he says it's too crazy that the President of the United States would order this to happen. But when he realizes this is the real deal, he puts together the people who hate each other, Greenpeace, the Native Americans, the oil companies, and the Russians, and together they get two of the three whales out from under the ice, and he lands a helicopter, a United States military helicopter, on the bow of a Russian icebreaker, and they get these whales out. And she's telling me this story, and I'm just mesmerized. And she tells me that she fell in love with him over the telephone because he was such an incredible leader. And she flies to Alaska, and she marries him. They have this incredible, idyllic life. And then he and his entire staff is killed in a plane crash.
No, I didn't know that.
And then she realizes unfortunately, from reality, that there is nothing in the United States military that helps the families transition from the deaths of their loved ones. And she creates it.
Okay.
TAPS, the Trauma Assistance Program for Survivors, which now has touched the lives of hundreds of thousands of military people across this country. So when I think about heroes, I think about people like Bonnie Lucas.
Yeah, that's great.
Who touched the lives of incredible people, and she is one of the people in my book.
And not just people, but other mammals too, in her part of those whales.
Right. Other,
you know,
and other mammals too. Yeah,
others,
right.
Other species. I remember seeing the movie, but who played her in the movie?
Jodie Foster. Oh no, I'm sorry. I'm wrong. Jodie Foster played one of the person who helped get the. No, I'm wrong.
No. I think you're thinking of Drew Barrymore.
Thank you.
Right, but she was kind of the Greenpeace person. I just can't think of who played her. The woman you just spoke
and
of.
I don't know that anybody actually played her.
Oh really?
She was catalyst for the movie.
Yeah, really. Well, I kind of remember that. Yeah, I remember the scene with, you know, of the government responding and people on the ground being suspicious that it was just a, you know, PR campaign
but this,
and whatever.
This
but
was all based on what she and her future husband actually did. When, by the way, in Casino.
Yeah, what was that?
I was a cop named Randy.
Oh, were you really? Oh, did he call you? Oh, wait. Do you come to his door when he's having a fight with Sharon Stone character and he calls you Randy and he asks you like how your wife is doing or how the kids are or something like that even?
And you know what? We ad-libbed that entire scene. None of that was actually written. But
Martin Scorsese
loved it and kept it in the movie. And that began my movie career.
Oh, that's so funny. I've seen Casino, I don't know, 15 times. And it still amazes me because I think it's a great movie. And yet, I mean, it's not as good as, to me, it's not as good as Goodfellas, but it's still.
I agree with you. I wish I got a part in Goodfellas.
Yeah. So, and then you were also in another couple of movies in a fictional part. Were you also police officers?
I was, in Fool's Rush In. I played a part of a Hoover Dam cop where I delivered Salma Hayek's baby on the bridge of Hoover Dam.
That's cool.
And then I was in Miss Congeniality 2, but I actually played a casino manager there. And then I co-starred in the pilot episode of Las Vegas with James Caan as a crook, finally.
Well, you've had experience on both ends of that, so I'm sure it's rubbed off on you. The book is The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. And thanks for your thoughts on the whole recording thing. It's very interesting that you were recording long before it was, you know, body cams and dash cams. Did you ever tell the people you were talking to that you were recording?
No.
That was one of the things we talked about last night, and how that might change. Obviously, people knew they were being recorded, but I'm also, I mean, because now we know lawsuits have gone down, right, because of body cams, that people who might have been trying to scam that way aren't doing that because of body cams as much, right?
Well, it's very interesting that the opposite effect that was sold to the American public is taking place, because the reality is that the complaints of impropriety.
I got about 10 seconds. I'm sorry. So yes, it's gotten better, which I'm glad to hear, but I'm sorry, I'm just about to run out of time. So Randy Sutton, thank you so much. We'll get to Switching Sides coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.